Chapter 1. Raven stood in the bedroom doorway, barefoot and dressed only in a man's white t-shirt. It was Steele's shirt, and it was very large on her, but Raven Scarpetti in an oversized, rumpled t-shirt looked about 10 times sexier than most women would have looked in garter belts, lacy merry widows, and spike heels. She stood leaning against the doorframe, her short, tousled black hair hanging down over her eyes, her lovely legs crossed and her arms folded across her chest, a look of melancholy in her eyes that would have set off a raging testosterone storm in most men. But Steele wasn't like most men. He was sitting in his reading chair, with his back to her and his feet up on the ottoman, holding a thick book in his lap. A glass of scotch and a rare pre-war bottle of Glenlivet stood on the small table beside the leather chair. He was reading in a leisurely manner, at the rate of about one page every half second. He didn't have to read that way. A great many books were available electronically on computer, and if Steele wished to, he could simply take a download on any book he chose. He could call the public library and read War and Peace over the phone in a matter of seconds, just like a computer took a download by modem. But he didn't consider that reading. He liked doing it the old-fashioned way. However, he couldn't help the fact that he could simply scan a page in a fraction of a second and retain full comprehension. Lately, he'd been reading a great deal, and the book and the floor around his reading chair was covered with stacks of library books. He easily went through a dozen or more each night. However, Raven knew that this wasn't simply reading for pleasure. This was reading for escape. She quietly came up behind his chair and leaned over his desk. He was reading Great Expectations by Charles Dickens.
"You've been thinking about her again, haven't you?"
she said softly. He closed the book. He required no bookmark. He'd remember exactly where he was. He looked up at her and met her gaze, then nodded.
"If there really was someone else," said Raven, "I think I could handle that. But I can't compete with a ghost. You've never even met her. You don't know who she is, but she's still managed to come between us. I just don't know how to handle that."
He reached up and gently took her hands. "I'm sorry," he said. "I don't mean to make it rough on you. I just can't seem to do anything about it."
"I know,"
she said.
"I wish there was something I could do to help."
"I don't know that there's anything anyone can do," he replied. "Short of letting Dr. Stone start poking around inside my circuitry."
"You know I don't like it when you talk that way,"
said Raven, disapprovingly.
"What other way is there to put it?" he asked. "I've got a malfunction."
"Stop it! You're not a machine!"
He raised his arm and the firing tube of his laser slid out through the gun port in his palm.
"What do you call that?"
he asked dryly.
"An artificial arm,"
she said.
"All right, so it's real fancy and tricked up, but that's all it is."
"And what about my brain?"
"What about it? So it's artificial too, so what? There are lots of people walking around with artificial limbs and organs. Does that make them machines? It isn't your body or your brain that makes you human, Steele. It's what's inside. All they did was transplant your personality from an organic brain into an artificial one. That hasn't changed you any, not deep down inside. You're still the same man you always were. You've just picked up some extra memories that once belonged to other people. Why can't you just accept that and deal with it? Why do you have to keep putting yourself through this?"
He sighed.
"I don't know."
"You think I could love a machine?"
she asked. He did not respond.
"Well, do you?"
"The question is," he said, "how would you feel if the man you thought you loved turned out to be a machine after all?"
"Thought I loved,"
she said.
"You know what I mean."
"No, I don't,"
she replied angrily.
"Why don't you tell me?"
"What if you're just fooling yourself?" he said, avoiding her gaze. "You keep telling me that I'm still human, that nothing's changed deep down inside, and God knows I keep wanting to believe you. But what if we're both wrong? I don't know, maybe I've been hanging around Cooper too long. But what if we're practicing what the shrinks call denial? Maybe you just want to believe I'm still human because you can't deal with the alternative, that you are in love with a machine."
She came around in front of him and crouched down at his knees.
"Just what is it that you think I love about you?"
she asked him.
"The fact that you can control yourself so well that you can fuck for hours? Big deal. A vibrator can do the same damn thing. That's not all that important to me. I used to fuck for a living, remember? Don't get me wrong. I love doing it with you. Only not because of how well or how long you can do it, but because it's you. You think maybe I'm in love with you because you're someone big and strong who can protect me? If that's what I was after, I could have found myself some badass pimp. Besides, I'm not exactly the type who needs protecting. I can take care of myself. So what else? You think maybe it's the way you look? I don't care about that either. You could have pimples and a beer belly for all the difference it makes. It's who you are that I'm in love with, you dumb bastard. I've known a lot of guys who were all flesh and blood who weren't half as human as you are.
He took her in his arms, arms that could easily crush her, and held her tenderly.
Sometimes I think you're all that keeps me sane, he said, nuzzling her hair.
I just can't stand to see you keep doing this to yourself,
she said.
When you hurt, I hurt.
For a long moment, they simply held each other, saying nothing.
Are you going to come to bed?
She asked softly. He hesitated.
Not just yet!
She pulled away from him.
Look, I know you don't have to sleep,
she said.
But those ghosts of yours aren't going to go away just because you stay awake. You've got to face them, Steele. You've got to accept them and deal with them.
It's not the ghosts themselves I'm worried about so much as what they mean, said Steele.
He exhaled heavily.
Ugh. I keep thinking about Mick. We were partners for a lot of years. He really had his head on straight. He was strong. He was the strongest, sanest man I ever knew. And look what happened to him.
That has nothing to do with you,
she said.
Doesn't it? I wish I could believe that. They put Mick together after they built me. He was supposed to be the new and improved model. Only he snapped. And they don't really know why. Maybe with him, this was the way it started. How do I know the same thing won't happen to me?
Because it won't,
she said.
I won't let it.
He smiled.
I wish it was that easy.
It is that easy,
she insisted.
Believe in yourself. Believe in me.
You're about the only thing I do believe in, he said.
She kissed him softly on the lips.
Don't stay up too long,
she said.
It gets lonely in that bed all by myself.
I'll be in soon.
She kissed him again and went back into the bedroom, softly closing the door behind her. Steele picked up the book again, then put it down once more. He poured himself another glass of whiskey. No worry there. Alcohol did not affect his cybernetic brain. He couldn't even get drunk. And if he ruined his liver, that was no great problem either. They could always give him another one. Once again, the thoughts of her came unbidden to his mind. It was strange. He thought about her more often than he thought about his ex-wife, Janice, or about his kids. He hadn't seen Jason since Corey died. He was living with his mother in Boston somewhere, trying to put his own life back together. Having a cyborg for a father was one complication that he didn't need. As for Janice, that had been over long ago, even before she had divorced him. That initial chemical imbalance that was sadly and all too often mistaken for love had worn off years ago, and they had grown apart, more and more becoming strangers to each other, staying together for the children's sake. Or perhaps simply because they had each been afraid to admit what had gone wrong. But Donna. Donna who? Who was she? He felt irrationally as if he had become obsessed with some other man's wife. She was some other man's wife, only a part of that man was now a part of him. And he didn't know who he was either. All he had was a first name. Jonathan. Not John, but Jonathan. What kind of man was a Jonathan, but not a John? Someone very formal? Someone stuffy? Someone slight and perhaps bookish, whom the shorter, stronger sounding name didn't seem to fit? Someone important? He didn't have a clue. All he knew about Jonathan was that he had left her. The memories that came to him in dreams were fragmented, but he'd managed to put some things together. Certain things he could discount, the vision of his own mother attacking Jonathan and Donna's children, for example. That was like an overlay of memories and experience. Jonathan and Donna had lost their children when they were attacked by a screamer. Steele had lost his brothers when his mother had been infected with virus 3 in the hospital where she worked and had come home raving mad, already breaking out in the hideous separating sores that marked the screamers. She had attacked his young brothers, bitten them, and would have infected him as well had not his father grappled with her and subdued her, becoming himself infected in the process. Knowing that he didn't have much time, Steele's father had taken his 45 Colt semi-automatic, set an agonizing goodbye to his oldest son, then shot his two younger sons and turned the pistol on himself. Steelhead watched it all in numb disbelief. He still had that pistol and carried it regularly. The old, antiquated .45 was the only thing he had left of his father's. Jonathan and Donna's experience had been equally traumatic. They had rushed their children to the hospital, but there had been nothing anyone could do. There was no cure for virus 3. By the time they arrived at the emergency room, the children were already showing signs of the disease, and it had taken four orderlies dressed in heavily padded protective clothing to drag them off and administer the lethal injections that the law required. Steele had managed to recover from his trauma. Jonathan apparently never had recovered from his. At least, not completely. After the children died, Donna was hospitalized with a nervous breakdown, irrationally blaming him for what had happened, and Jonathan had withdrawn from her, unable to forgive her for leaving him to deal with it alone. Steele knew that Jonathan had started cheating on Donna with her younger sister, but he had no memory of her at all. That was a part of Jonathan that he had not inherited. After that, there was a blank. And then another memory fragment, that of a small restaurant or lounge where Jonathan and Donna had met for the last time, with little booths and tables covered in with red and white checkered tablecloths and movie posters on the bare brick walls. It was where Jonathan had proposed to her, and having forgotten all that, it was where he had thoughtlessly decided to tell her that he was leaving. The image of Donna sitting there, her eyes welling up with tears, telling Jonathan she loved him and begging him not to go, was so startlingly real and vivid, it seemed as if Steele had been there himself. But he didn't know the place, he had no idea where it was, and when he dreamed of Donna calling out to Jonathan, it felt as if she were calling out to him, begging him not to leave her, telling him she loved him and she needed him. How the hell could that bastard have walked out on her? Steele hated having Jonathan's memories inside his mind, but there was nothing he could do about it, short of allowing himself to be debugged, to have the ghost fragments excised from his engram matrix. But what else would they erase? What precious memories of his own might become forever lost in the process? He had asked both Devin Cooper and Higgins to find Jonathan for him, or at least to tell him who he was, but so far they had not been able to do so. When the cyborg that had been Mick Taylor ran amok in the project lab, he had utterly demolished it along with most of the project download records. They had never kept anything in hard copy. It was all stored in the computers. Now that information was lost, and most of the original download personnel had been killed. Higgins was trying to track down the original subjects of the download experiments, but so far, he had not found Jonathan, and looking for him was not one of his priorities. Whoever Jonathan was, Steele would have to try to find him on his own. And the only clues he had were those buried inside his own mind, those small pieces of Jonathan that had become part of himself. If he could find Jonathan or remember who he was, perhaps he could find Donna. Then what? What could he possibly say to her? She'd look at him and see a total stranger, a cyborg, a creature who was part man and part machine, who had somehow inherited a part of her own tragedy. And he would look at her and see a woman he had loved once, a woman who had borne his children, a woman he had hurt. But, of course, he hadn't actually done any of those things. Jonathan had. Still, a part of Jonathan possessed him like some sort of electronic incubus. But if Jonathan had been able to turn his back to her pain, Steele could not. It wasn't fair to Raven. She didn't deserve this. She had stood by him through some of the worst times he had had. She had fought beside him. She had opened up to him and given him her love and trust and friendship, the most human of commodities. And it wasn't fair to make her live with the memory of someone else's past. But because it was a part of him now, it was a part of Steele's past as well. A past that he had never lived through, though it was just as real as if he had. He drained the whiskey glass and made a face. What good was it if you couldn't even get a buzz? If you couldn't dull the pain? Whose lousy guilt was he feeling? Jonathan's or his own? His thoughts turned to the man who had once been his partner and best friend. Mick had caught it the same day as Steele himself had been shot down. The same day they both should have died. Only somewhere deep inside, some indomitable spark had kept them both alive. They had rebuilt Steele as the first prototype, and then they'd rebuilt Mick. Only Mick went crazy almost as soon as he was brought online. That hadn't been Mick anymore. It was someone else. A tormented creature that had been driven to kill in order to expiate his own pain. How many ghosts had Mick had? How many fragmented and disjointed memories that once belonged to other people had echoed screaming through the engram matrix that had been his mind? Steele could not rid himself of the nagging fear that what had happened to Mick Taylor would happen to him as well. He was terrified of going insane. He had so precious little of his old self left. He didn't want to lose it all. The phone rang. Steele picked it up.
"Steele," he said irritably. "It's late. This had better be important. We need to talk."
A cold fist grabbed his guts and started squeezing.
"Who the hell is this?
Don't you recognize my voice?"
Steele slammed down the phone, breaking the connection. The voice on the other end of the receiver had been his own. The door to the bedroom opened.
"Is everything all right?"
asked Raven sleepily.
"Who is that on the phone?"
"Wrong number," Steele said, trying to keep his voice steady. Go back to bed. I'll be there in a minute."
The phone rang once more. Steele snatched it up and ripped the cord out from the wall. Raven stared at him.
"Steele, what is it? What's the matter?"
"Nothing. Go back to bed."
She looked as if she were about to say something, but she changed her mind and went back into the bedroom. A moment later, she heard the front door open and close. She sat down in the bed and bit her lower lip. She wanted to get dressed and go after him, but she knew he wouldn't want that. Whatever was bothering him, he'd have to work it out on his own, the way he always did. She got into bed and pulled the sheets over her, but she knew she wouldn't get to sleep anytime soon. Dev Cooper rolled over in bed and sleepily reached for the phone.
"Yeah? Who is it?"
"You haven't told him?"
Dev came awake instantly, sitting bolt upright in bed. He knew that voice as well as he knew his own.
"Matrix?"
"You say that as if it's my name. Hell, I suppose it will do as well as any other. I can't exactly lay claim to the name of Dev Donovan Steele. Somebody else already has it."
Dev glanced at the glowing numbers of the digital clock on his nightstand. It was 2:30 in the morning.
"Where are you?"
"Interesting question. Since I haven't got a body, I'm not really anywhere, am I?"
"You're able to talk. You've got Steele's voice."
"It happens to be my voice, too."
"That isn't what I meant. You're using some sort of voice synthesizer peripheral somewhere. So you must be calling from some kind of..."
"Save it,"
said the Matrix.
"You're way behind, Dev. It isn't necessary for me to be booted up in a computer somewhere that's equipped with audio peripherals. I've gone way beyond that. I can access just about anything I want. I can link up with hardware in a dozen different places or more, all at the same time. I've been busy learning about this strange new life I have. It's astonishing what I can do. By the way, did you know there's a trace on your line?"
"Nah," said Cooper. "But I'm not really surprised. Higgins?"
"Who else? Don't worry, though. I've rerouted it. At the moment, they're listening to a couple of young gay women talking dirty to each other on the phone. They're probably torn between trying to figure out how their phone lines got crossed and wanting to hear the rest of the conversation."
"So they can't trace you to your source?"
said Dev.
"No, and it wouldn't really help them if they could. I can move much faster than they can. And I've taken certain precautions. I stored backup copies of myself, hidden in dozens of different databanks. I can interface with any of them in an instant. I'm one program they can't wipe. However, I wasn't really worried about them trying to trace me. I just wanted to make sure that we could talk in private."
"I see," said Cooper, still somewhat stunned. "How are you?"
The question seemed insane.
"I mean, hell, I don't know what I mean. Are you all right?"
"I was about to ask you the same thing,"
the Matrix said.
"Last time we spoke, you were in a pretty bad way."
"Yeah," said Cooper. I'm better now. I've dried out. No more booze or pills."
He reached for his pack of cigarettes and lit one up. His hand was trembling slightly. It was scary. It was as if he were talking to Steele on the phone. In a sense, he was, only this was a different Steele. Different, yet still the same.
"I'm glad to hear that,"
said the Matrix.
"Are you back on the job?"
"Yes."
"You've been seeing Steele?"
Yes.
"So why haven't you told him about me?"
How do you know I haven't?"
And the moment that he said it, he knew.
"You spoke to him?"
"Only a short while ago. I'm afraid I gave him a pretty bad turn. I felt sure you would have told him. Why the hell didn't you?"
I wanted to," Dev swallowed nervously. "But Higgins and Dr. Stone both felt it would have been counterproductive. They're worried about how Steele might react."
That's not all they're worried about,
said the Matrix.
What do you mean?
Look at your TV.
The TV set in Cooper's bedroom suddenly came on all by itself. There was no sound, but the picture did not require it. It showed the interior of Oliver Higgins' office at the Federal Building. The footage had been shot from a high angle, and it was a moment before Dev realized that what we was seeing had been recorded by the surveillance camera mounted just below the ceiling in the corner of the office. Higgins always turned it on whenever he went out. Obviously, he had not been aware that it was on when this footage had been shot. Nor had Jennifer Stone. She was lying back across the office desk, her blouse completely open and her bra unhooked, her dress pushed up around her waist, her long legs wrapped around Higgins, and as he thrust away at her, his pants down around his ankles. Her head was rolling back and forth, her eyes were shut, her mouth open and gasping. "Jesus Christ," whispered Cooper. "Turn it off, for heaven's sake." The screen went blank. "Do they know about this tape?" asked Cooper.
"They know. I played it for them to give them a taste of their own medicine. Let them know what it's like to have Big Brother watching. And, coincidentally, to let them know I've got a little leverage. It makes them crazy. Knowing that I've got this, there's nothing they can do about it."
That explained Jennifer's reaction whenever he brought up the subject of the Matrix, Cooper thought. It was something personal. It was about as personal as it could be.
"I want you to explain the steal about me,"
said the Matrix.
"I thought you already spoke to him," said Cooper.
"I tried to call him. He hung up on me. I think I scared the hell out of him. I imagine it must be pretty unsettling getting a phone call from yourself. I had no idea that he didn't know. I tried to call him back, but he must have ripped the phone out of the wall. The line went dead. I decided not to try to contact him again until I'd spoken with you."
Cooper closed his eyes and sighed.
"Damn it! God only knows what he must be thinking. I better call him right away."
"You can't,"
the Matrix said.
"The phone's out, remember?"
"Oh, yeah," said Cooper. "Well, at least he's not alone. Raven's with him."
"Tell me about Raven."
The door to Cooper's bedroom suddenly opened and Kurt Samuels came in. There was another man with him, one Cooper did not know. The second man looked out of breath.
"What's going on?" Samuels demanded. "Who are you talking to?"
Cooper gave a guilty start, then recovered.
"For Christ's sake, Kurt, I'm talking on the phone!"
Samuels came over to the bed, snatched the receiver from him, and put it to his ear. He listened for a moment, then grimaced wryly and handed it back to him.
"Sorry, Doc, I guess I overreacted. Look, we'll just pretend this didn't happen, okay?"
He turned to the other man and said witheringly,
"You asshole!"
"But I thought..."
"You didn't think! That's just the trouble. Get the hell out of here and leave the man alone."
Samuel shoved the other man out, followed him, and closed the door behind him. Cooper stared at the door, totally confused. He brought the receiver back up to his ear and heard a woman's breathy voice saying,
"And then I'd like to put my head down between your legs and very slowly, very gently."
Cooper quickly put the receiver back in its cradle and blushed. Oliver Higgins was lying naked in his bed, his wrists and ankles tied to the corners of the bedposts with silk cords. He felt a little silly, but at the same time, he felt turned on. He worried about himself sometimes. He was a fit, attractive man in his late 40s, and not sexually inexperienced by any means, but this was a little on the weird side. He had always considered himself pretty normal sexually. He had never really done anything that could be considered kinky. However, since he had become involved with Jennifer, his horizons had been considerably broadened. For most of her adult life, Jennifer Stone had been a virgin, something he still found difficult to believe. A woman who looked like that. But she had purposely kept men at a distance. For one thing, she was far more intelligent than most men, a genius-level intellect. For another, she was extremely independent. She was not the type to take a backseat to any man. Most men expected the women in their lives to put them first, above everything else. Jennifer Stone wasn't about to do anything like that for anyone. In a lot of the ways, the two of them were very much alike. It was why they worked so well together, both personally and professionally. Both of them had strong, aggressive, independent personalities. Both of them had built their lives around their careers and had little time or patience for distractions. Both of them liked having things on their own terms, and as a result, had never really been able to function very well within relationships. Higgins had dealt with that by keeping his relationships extremely short and purely sexual. Jennifer had dealt with it by not having any relationships at all and channeling all her energies into her work. However, since they first got together, Jennifer had been making up for lost time with a vengeance. After all those years of self-denial, the floodgates had burst and her torrid sexuality was overflowing. She wanted to try everything. And the fact that it was all still new to her was, in and of itself, exciting. Higgins had done things with her that he had never done with any other woman. Things that would never even have occurred to him before. Not that Jennifer was some paragon of sexual sophistication, far from it. He had been the first man she'd ever been with, but she was an engineer, and she approached her sexual education with the same systematic thoroughness with which she attacked engineering problems. She researched the subject from every angle, selected avenues of approach, and then exhausted every possibility. Usually, she exhausted him as well. The door to the bathroom opened, and Jennifer came out. Higgins caught his breath. "Holy shit," he said. She looked like something out of a science fiction movie. She was dressed in a one-piece, skin-tight suit of gleaming, wet-look, black patent leather. She had on matching spike-heeled boots and studded gauntlets and a mask made from the same material. Her long, red hair cascaded down her shoulders. She held a cat-o'-nine-tails in her hand. She slowly came over to the bed. "Now, wait a minute," Higgins said. He suddenly felt nervous. His wrists and ankles were firmly bound, effectively immobilizing him. She lifted the cat and ran the tails through her other hand. "Hey, Jen, I don't know about this," Higgins said uneasily. "This is a little freaky."
"Did I tell you to talk?" she said in an ominous tone.
"What?"
"You don't say anything unless I tell you to," she said, moving around the bed and flourishing the cat. "Otherwise, you'll have to be punished."
Higgins chuckled nervously. "Oh, come on, Jennifer. This is kind of silly, don't you think?" The cat whistled through the air and came down with a sharp crack on the headboard just beside him. Higgins jerked, startled.
"Jesus Christ, are you crazy?"
She leaned down quickly and put the handle of the cat up underneath his chin.
"Silence," she commanded. "If you say one more word, I'll be forced to gag you."
He stared up at her with disbelief. Behind the leather mask, her eyes were gleaming. She straightened and stood over him, then gently ran the cat across his chest, barely touching him with it. It raised goosebumps.
"This will be a new experience for you, Oliver," she said. "Usually you're the one who gives the orders. You're the one who's in control. A powerful man in a position of great responsibility, with subordinates who jump at your slightest word. But not now."
She dragged the tip of the cat across his stomach, barely touching his skin, slowly going lower. Higgins swallowed hard. He was starting to breathe heavily.
Now that you're hopeless," she said, "no longer in control. You don't get to speak unless I tell you to. You don't get to move unless I let you. Doesn't it feel interesting? Isn't it a novel sensation? I can do anything I want with you, Oliver. Anything. Anything at all."
The cat slowly caressed his groin. Higgins closed his eyes.
"I can give you pleasure, or I can give you pain," she said. "I wonder, which one do you think I'll choose?"
The phone rang.
"Damn," she said.
"Fuck it. Let it ring," said Higgins.
"Better not,"
she said, dropping the cat on the bed, her tone of voice once more completely professional.
"This time of night it could be important," she grimaced. "Anyway, this suit is hot as hell and this wasn't working all that well."
Higgins swallowed hard and cleared his throat. "Oh, I don't know about that," he said. She took off the mask and unzipped the suit and sat down beside him on the edge of the bed, picked up the receiver and held it to his ear. "Hello?" said Higgins a bit hoarsely. He cleared his throat again. "Hello?"
"Hello, Higgins. Remember me?"
He frowned. "Steel? Is that you?"
"Not exactly. At least, it's not the Steel you think it is."
His eyes went wide. "Matrix!" Jennifer stiffened. "Hold on a minute," Higgins said. He jerked his head and Jennifer removed the receiver.
"Put it on the speakerphone," he said. "And get these damn things off me."
She She switched on the speaker and quickly started to untie him. Matrix? You still there?
I'm still here. Don't bother trying to tap the call, Trace Higgins. It won't help you any.
There's no Trace on this line, said Higgins. It's secure. Where are you?
Never mind that. Are you alone or is your playmate with you?
Jennifer glanced at the speaker with a look of cold fury. If you mean Dr. Stone, yes, she's here, said Higgins tensely. What do you want?
I just spoke to Dev Cooper,
said the Matrix.
He tells me you two are the only reason why Steele hasn't been told about me. I want him told. I want him to be given a full explanation.
That wouldn't be very wise, said Higgins, moistening his lips nervously. Steele's under a great deal of pressure right now. He's only recently come out of reconstructive surgery after his last mission, and he needs some time to fully recuperate. When the time is right, we'll tell him, but he needs to be prepared. He needs time to get used to the idea.
You're stalling, Higgins. I want him told now. He deserves to know about me.
Look, I want you to stay away from him, said Higgins. You'll only make things worse. You don't know what's involved. This is an extremely sensitive issue.
You remember a certain tape I showed you once?
The Matrix asked. Jennifer finished untying him and now she froze, staring at him with alarm. Higgins compressed his lips into a tight grimace. Yeah, I remember.
I do like it to be broadcast during the evening news. That time slot should guarantee a pretty good audience, don't you think?
Damn you! Higgins said through clenched teeth. That's blackmail!
You're absolutely right, Higgins said. Don't tell me it's some sort of thing the agency hadn't done before. You should be used to it. Tell him, Higgins. Tell him tomorrow, first thing in the morning, or you and Dr. Stone are going to make it a big on prime time.
The line went dead. Jennifer made a sound halfway between a growl and a groan and sprang toward the nightstand, upsetting it and throwing it down onto the floor. The speakerphone fell as it came crashing down. The clock went flying and the lamp shattered. Higgins jumped up and grabbed her. She struggled against him for a moment, trying to pull away, then turned toward him and started hammering on his chest with her fists. Do something! Calm down, said Higgins, shaking her. There's nothing we can do. God! She said, standing there, shaking with fury, clenching her fists. We'll have to do what it says, said Higgins. We've got no choice. There's got to be a way, said Jennifer. To do what? Asked Higgins. She stared at him, her eyes cold and hard.
To kill it,
she said. End of chapter.